Now, the subject that I want to talk to you about is called surrogacy. It's a very modern shaila because back in the day they didn't have such a thing. So if a woman can get pregnant but she cannot carry to term, the ball game is not over. It's not all lost. There is a possibility. And again, there are many different variations. Maybe we'll get into that later. But let's talk about the following scenario. What they can do is, after the husband and wife have an intimate relationship and there's conception, the linkage between the sperm of the husband and the beta, which is called the egg of the wife, that is called a zygote in medical terms. That zygote can now, in the most modern technology, can be transferred over to a recipient, a surrogate, a host mother. Now, there are many, many different issues that the halacha has to address. One issue that I want to focus on today is an issue, and I'm going to show you that the secular courts have dealt with this issue in many, many different Western countries, so it's not a uniquely Jewish issue, but we have to know what is the Jewish answer to this question, and that's the issue of who the mother is. So if you take a look at an article here that was published in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society, and this dates back 20 years already, there's an article called Surrogate Motherhood in the Case of High-Risk Pregnancy. And it was written by a team of a rabbi and a physician. They teamed up to do the research. And what you should have in front of you is page 10, I think. Let me just see if I'm right. It should say on the towards the bottom of page 10, maternity issues.
Yes.
Now let's just speak about the halachic significance of maternity issues. If you're interested in the secular writings on this issue, then you could read extensively in the footnotes here, especially at the end of footnote 16, which is on page 11, and he picks it up later in other footnotes as well. But we're going to focus on the halachic consideration. Now, why is this halachically so critical? Can anybody think of a number of issues that could come up if you don't know who the mother of the child is?
Jewishness.
Correct. Let's say the mother is the... Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say the mother because we don't know who the mother is. But what I mean is the genetic mother whose egg was fertilized, was conceived, she's Jewish. And the birth mother is not Jewish. And then we can flip it around. What happens if we take the zygote from a non-Jewish woman? The egg has already been conceived together with the sperm, and now we transfer it over to a Jewish host woman. She's the surrogate mother. Who's the mother? So what's the status of the child? Is the child Jewish or not Jewish?
Well, the issue has to be based on the neshama, which is...
I don't know anything about neshamas. Maybe the answer to the neshama will be at the halachic answer, meaning whatever the halacha determines, that's what's going to happen with the neshama. You know what I mean? We're in charge of the neshama.
The biological mother, being Jewish, the neshama is going to be, the baby is going to be a Jewish baby, meaning that the neshama is a Jewish neshama.
I doubt if that's the case. I have a feeling that most poskim would say that even though the Jewish woman gave birth, she's just what we would... Again, I don't want to be harsh here and use a term that might insult anybody, but she's just an incubator, you know. Yeah.
Rent a womb.
Yeah, rent a woman, right. So the child would not be Jewish. But anyway, let's...
The zygote came from a Jewish mother.
Okay, but at what? Wait a minute. What was the case again? Jewish mother.
Oh, that's a different situation.
A Jewish mother.
Oh, wait a second. I'm confused. Just give me a minute to clear my... I thought we were talking about a case where the zygote came from a non-Jew and was transferred over to a Jew.
No.
And you were saying that the neshama has to be Jewish. No, we're talking about the other.
No, I'm saying that the zygote comes from a Jewish mother.
Right.
Therefore, the neshama has to be Jewish.
No. The neshama doesn't enter into the guf in the zygote. In fact, all
it's
the
30 days later.
Ah, okay. So we
okay,
can talk about 30 days
since
later.
Since zygote, it doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter.
The neshama probably comes in 30 days later, not at the state of it. There's no neshama in zygote. In fact, even the issues of abortion only apply after a certain period of time, whether it's the first trimester or it's 30 days. You know, you have to go through the laws of abortion. But to abort a zygote, again, it might be awesome, but it's certainly not...
The genetic information is from a Jewish mother, but that doesn't impact the halakha necessarily.
Right.
I think I've read both sides of it, actually, at different
times.
Oh, sides.
Excellent. So you gentlemen are well up. But I don't know if you're aware of the fact that Chazal actually addressed this question. We have to close this door. If anyone leaves the room, please close the door. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Okay. So now, Rav Osa, we have the following. A Gemara with regard to Arla. Okay, we'll get to that. And we have a Gemara with regard to Basa B'Cholov. We have a Gemara with regard to Gerus. And finally, we have a Gemara that deals with Esther Amalka. There's another statement in Chazal that's relevant, and that is, who is the mother of Dina? We'll get back to that later, but that's not in the Gemara. So in Chazal, we can divide it up into Talmudic sources as opposed to Midrashic sources. And in Talmudic sources, we have, to best of my knowledge, four different sugyas, four different Talmudic locations that address this question. Let's begin with Arla. Okay then? Now, in the pages that I gave out to you, turn to page 11. And again, if at any point I quote a page that you don't have, somebody could volunteer to just run over here and photocopy that page. I didn't photocopy all the sources. It just goes on and on. So what happens on page 11? First of all, in order to understand who was studying, you would look at footnote number 17. And this is a sefer called Vayelaket Yosef that was published over a century ago. And this tshuva, this responsa by Rav Binyamin Aryeh Weiss, is quoted extensively in the modern literature dealing with the contemporary issue of surrogacy. What did the Vayelaket Yosef see in the laws of Arla that would lead him to one or of two conclusions about who the mother is in the case of surrogacy? Now again, I got distracted because of your question, so maybe we can hold the questions for a few minutes, because otherwise it's so complicated. Give me a few minutes. I got distracted. I was asking you before, what is the relevancy of determining who the mother is, whether it's the genetic mother or the host mother, the birth mother? So you answered to me the question David answered me of Jewishness. Let's go beyond that. Let's assume, for example, that the child is certainly Jewish, but the question, who is the mother? Why would that be tremendously relevant? Forget about Jewishness. There's no question the child is Jewish. What?
Forbidden relationships.
Excellent. For Erva. We have to know who are the siblings of this child. This child, let's say, is a male, I'm just giving you an example, and he wants to marry a female, and she happens to be his own sister. Mm-hmm. Now, what would make him her sister? Well, it depends. If she's a daughter to the first mother, and the first mother is the mother, or to the second mother, the surrogate mother, and that's his sister. So we have to really clarify this. In fact, if we were discussing today, which we're not, whether halacha would be in favor of surrogacy, one of the arguments to the negative would be, maybe there's such confusion, he'll end up marrying his own sister. Now they have another issue. Fascinating issue. And that is Pidyon HaBen. Now, Pidyon HaBen, as opposed to the laws of inheritance, depend upon not the father but the mother. That's called Peter Rechem. Now, the question is she or he, whoever's born, let's say, is that a Peter Rechem to the to the genetic mother or to the second mother. So we'll talk about that. Then we have to talk about Yerusha, because sometimes if a woman dies and she doesn't have a husband to inherit her, then her inheritance transfers to her children. Well, does this child have a right to inherit the genetic mother, the mother whose conception was that, or the surrogate mother? So I'm just giving you a flavor of a vast array of what we call nafkaminas that depend upon who the mother is. So when you determine motherhood, that is a halachically extremely significant issue. What did the Vayelaket Yosef see in Orla? Listen to the following case. Fascinating. You and I know that Orla applies to a tree during how many years?
Four.
Well, Orla actually is only 3 years. The fourth year is called Revai. So let's try to figure out what would be the law in the following case. You have a tree that's within its first 3 years, and there's a branch on the tree, and you cut off that branch. How do you pronounce that? Branch? Is
branch.
That it?
Branch.
Okay, whatever your pronunciation is. And because I'm very sensitive to my American English, and then they top it off and they say you're from Brooklyn, you know, that's even worse. Okay, so you cut off the branch, and now you graft it onto another tree. Why would you want to graft it onto another tree in the halachic sense? I'm not talking about agricultural. Is because the second tree, we'll call it the recipient tree, is not Orla. I mean, it's after its, let's say, fourth year of production. And now we have to ask the following question. If the branch is capable of producing its fruit, right? So all the necessary, shall I say, potential, you know, cells or seeds are there. But the problem is that once you cut off the branch, it's going to die. It needs nutrients. It needs an atmosphere which will embrace it, so to speak, and give it what it needs in order to go ahead and produce. So the moment you cut off that branch, you know, now the future of this branch in terms of its productivity is, so to speak, in question. But what does he do? He's a smarty, he's a chacham, he's an Ibra chacham, he's the chacham from the Manish Tanah. So what does he do? He decides to graft this branch onto another tree which is not Arla. What happens when this branch produces its fruit? Is the fruit Arla or is it not Arla? And it all depends. If you're telling me, well, the potential for that branch to produce, because all the seeds and whatever was necessary was already there, you know, it's a mature branch, then it's Arla. Any fruit that grows from the branch is Arla. But if, as a result of grafting, that seedling or that branch loses its what? Its identity, it now becomes Batel, so to speak. It now takes on the identity of the recipient tree, then it's not Arla. And he succeeded exactly in what he's doing. And before we get to the final answer to this question, in Arla there is a definite answer. I can ask you the following question. Is this similar to surrogacy? And the answer, in my opinion, again, you're the jury, you could disagree with me, is absolutely yes. Why? Because the zygote, once transferred over to the recipient host mother, is perfectly ready in potential to produce human life. But the only problem is, as soon as you remove the zygote from its mother, its genetic mother, it has no means to survival, right? So where's the incubator? How do we give the child, you know, this fetus, the nutrients and the atmosphere and everything it needs? We're going to have to transfer it over to the host mother. Who's going to actually facilitate the ability for this embryo to develop and mature and finally to come out into this world as a viable being? It's the host mother. Have you followed me? Again, why am I... If you think I'm excited about this, you are underestimating my level of passion. Because to me, this is mind-boggling. Nobody really ever thought of surrogacy as a viable option. Again, maybe somebody wrote a science fiction work, you know, 100 years ago and dreamed about surrogacy, but we're talking about a mission in our law that was given almost 2,000 years ago. And it's an exact parallel to surrogacy. What's the halach in our law?
Permitted.
It's permitted. Well, not a question of permitted. There's no Iser Arla now. Why? Because once you graft that branch, that seedling, onto the new tree, it loses its original identity. The new tree is providing it with all the necessary nutrients and all the atmospheric conditions that are necessary for that branch to produce fruit. And hence, it is completely lost and for its identity. It's part of the new tree. What would be now the equation to surrogacy?
The surrogate mother is the real mother.
The surrogate mother, the host mother, is the real mother.
What?
She provides whatever is necessary.
In,
just 1 second.
Okay.
In order for that.
I see the difference.
Well, I can't answer two questions at once.
Okay.
So, in fact, I don't think I should answer any questions now because I have a lot to tell you today. But I think we should suspend that question until we get to a point at which we're a little bit familiar. But okay, since you insisted, and we haven't seen you in months, when was the last time you were here?
June.
June. Yeah. Wow, that's about 5 months ago.
So you're saying that when you put a branch of the tree that's Orla onto the tree that's not, you're saying that does that tree, as opposed to the branch, does that tree change status?
No, the branch changes.
The branch changes,
right.
So, and that's because once you cut off that branch from the tree that's Orla, it cannot sustain itself by itself. It has to be put together.
I'm not sure if you have to add that. I added that to dramatize it. But the main point is that where is this branch going to flourish? Where is it going to gain what it needs in order to produce fruit?
Well, actually, you can just put it in the ground.
Okay, but I'm asking you, he didn't put it in the ground. He put it into a tree.
Okay.
Where is the host that's going to provide whatever, in this case, is necessary until finally that branch will produce fruit? It is the new tree. And this is what the halach is in Arla, that now this branch gains or attains, if you will, the identity of the new tree, the recipient tree. That's a mind-boggling concept.
Right, I
would have said that this new tree is nothing more than an incubator. It's nothing more than a physical, you know, a host or a... No! The halacha is it gains a brand new status. The recipient tree now takes in this branch and adopts it as its own.
Okay,
and that's an interesting...
So the word you used just now, you've never seen me before, so I have my... I also have some...
But everybody here knows you. It's just I'm the only one who ever saw you. Am I right?
I had the pleasure of meeting you for the first time.
Good to be... Nice to meet you. What's your name again?
Marvin Factor. I think when the tree receives the branch, that tree is not an incubator. It is a consumer. It takes over that whole new branch. That branch is now part and parcel of the tree. The zygote that is transferred to it as surrogate is not part and parcel of the mother.
But again, why is the zygote...
The mother is merely the incubator.
And why is
the same
it
as the tree?
Why not?
If that branch becomes part and parcel...
Why?
Because the branch is now growing through the mother tree, it is not incubating it.
I don't know, I'm not sure. Again, maybe you know more about agriculture than I do, but I would assume that the parallel is exact because to the same extent that the tree provides those nutrients that are necessary, but all the potential is inherent in this sapling, in this branch. Everything is there. Nothing is missing. It needs an atmosphere. Okay. Let's go on because again we have a lot to accomplish. You should know.
Just one other thing.
No. I'm sorry. At this point, I have to pull rank. At this point, I'll be here on both sides for the rest of the day.
That's fine.
But I got a deadline because Rabbi Myers told me the bell is going to ring. So I got to fit in everything until that bell rings.
Okay.
So you'll have to be mindful of me, but I'm going to take your questions afterwards.
Thank you.
I just want to point out the following: that Rabbi Binyamin Aryeh Weiss, the author of Vayilake Yosef, was dealing with a whole different question. Again, he didn't imagine in his period of time an actual surrogacy situation. What was actually suggested at that time, and again, I don't know all the details, but what seems to have been a theoretical, hypothetical possibility that the scientists were talking about was something called ovarian transplant. Now imagine if, let's say, a woman has to have her ovaries removed, mm-hmm. right? What we used to call it a hysterectomy, I don't know what they call it today. And now, from a deceased woman, they can take out her ovary and transplant it into the recipient in order to save her life, perhaps. Or moreover, let's say that second ovary would now become pregnant, would she, the recipient, become the mother? And I would say that in that case, for sure she becomes the mother. Why? Because there was no zygote in the ovary.
Right.
Do you follow my point? Yeah. Anyway, that's Hakofa Aleph. That's the first round. Now we go on to another sugya. And this is on page 12. This is a Gemara in Yevamos. I believe I gave it to you in the Hebrew pages. If I'm not mistaken, let me just see if I did. Oh, no. It's actually quoted on page 5 by the sources that I gave you. And let me just convey to you, in footnote number 20, you'll see in the English version, Yevamos Daf Sadi Zayin Amid Beis. So the Gemara wants to know the following. What happens if a non-Jewish woman becomes pregnant, in this case with twins, and then, during the course of pregnancy, she converts? So that's called, listen carefully, in the language of the Gemara, and Belina, you'll look it up inside, Hora Oso, which means it's conception, Shalobikdusha is another way of saying non-Jewish, Viledoso Bikdusha. Now, the Gemara wants to know, because that's the subject of Masechta Yevamos, are these twins brothers? What does that mean? If they are brothers, then from the perspective of Masechta Yevamos, if one of these two twins later on down the line gets married and unfortunately passes on without leaving children, then the other twin, assuming that they're brothers, would be required to either, he has two choices. What are those two choices?
Yibum
or Chalitza. If, on the other hand, he's not my brother, so then there's no mitzvah upon me to be miyabim his wife, his widow, or to give her chalitza. Are these two twins brothers? If you'd ask a non-Jew that question, we'd laugh you out of the ballpark. I mean, for sure they're brothers. They may be even identical twins, but halachically, it becomes immensely more complicated. Why? Because we have a principle in the laws of Gerus, and this is the most fundamental principle in Gerus, Ger shenizgayer kikaton shenoladomi, which means that a ger is not related to his relatives. Again, is he biologically related to his relatives? No one can deny that. In terms of genetics, they're related. But nevertheless, halakhically, he's a new being. And according to Jewish law, he is not related to any of his biological relatives. That's called a ger shenizgayer. Now, if we assume that motherhood depends upon conception, depends upon the genetics, then at the moment that these twins were conceived, what kind of hora, meaning pregnancy, was there? Was that Bikdusha or Shalobikdusha? Everybody? Shalobikdusha, because she was Catholic at the time that she became pregnant. Therefore, when these boys are born later through a process of Gerus, now exactly how that Gerus works is in and of itself complicated. It has to do with what's called Uber Yerech Imo, which means that when she is Misgayer and dips herself in the mikvah, that process of tevila relates not just to her own body, but also to the fetus in her womb. So again, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but let's assume that the gerus of the mother midway, let's say, through her pregnancy is valid even to the two fetus I just made that up.
Fetuses
in her womb. But now the question is, are they brothers? Are they related to each other? So if we activate the principle of gerus here, going back to the point of conception, that their relationship to their mother is completely severed. Why? Because when they become gerim is kekotin shenolad dami. Or do we say no? That the mother of this child is the birth mother. Now again, it's all one same mother, but here's the nafkamina, here's the difference. Because if she gave birth as the mother of these two twins, then they share the same mother, and that makes them into brothers. Are you following me? In other words, although they may have the status of gerim, but it doesn't matter because when they're born, they are related to their birth mother. And guess what? What do you think the Gemara's conclusion is in Yevamos Daf Tzadi Tes Tzadi Zayin Amid Beis? They are brothers. Why? Because they share the same mother. Again, what does that prove? Who is the mother? Is it the genetic mother? Because if it's the genetic mother, they're not related. Or is it the birth mother? And if it's the birth mother, then they are brothers. And the Gemara concludes they are brothers. What do you see from this Gemara? The surrogate mother, like we saw before in the case of Orla, is considered the mother. So take a look on page 12 and just peruse page 12 very quickly. And he's quoting Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. Has anybody heard of him? He's the head of the rabbinic court here in Yerushalayim. And he writes that since the Talmudic rule is that twins that are conceived by a Gentile mother who converted to Judaism during gestation, meaning during Horah, during the period of she carrying the baby, are considered children of the same mother. They are maternal brothers with all the implications thereof. And given that conversion to Judaism generally severs family relationships, how could it be that they're related to their, let's say, genetic mother when she was not Jewish? So now they became gerim, they're not related to their genetic mother who's not Jewish. The answer is they're related to the birth mother who is Jewish because she underwent conversion during the course of her pregnancy. Therefore, maternity, says Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, must be established by birth. And at that point, she had already converted to Judaism, and therefore the relationship between these two brothers to their mother is that of sons to their mother. She is their mother, and hence they are brothers because they share the same mother. And this argument was accepted by, take a look at the list here, it's like a who's list. In Jewish poskim, modern contemporary poskim. The first one on this list is Rav Eliezer Waldenberg. I don't know if you knew of him. He died about maybe 15, 20 years ago. He wrote, if I would have, you know, a shelf of all his tshuvas, I would have to add a second shelf. I think there are well over 15 volumes to his work. He also sat on the high court. Does anybody hear of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik? And here he quotes his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who was my father's Rebbe and my father's Masada Kedushin. He married off my parents. Rav Yisrael Meir Lau was also the chief rabbi of Israel. Rav Moshe Hirschler from Chicago. Anyone here from Chicago? Rav Moses Sternbach. He's the head of the Badatz. Rav Yosef Elyashiv. Unbelievable. It's like one after the other. The halachic mother and a surrogate relationship is the birth mother. And in this footnote, he points out that Rav Waldenberg draws an analogy based on the tshuva of Rav Binyamin Weiss that we saw before, the Alkut, what was it called? The Vayilakeit Yosef. And that means that based on Orla, he supports the position that the surrogate mother is indeed the mother. However, he tells you that in the secular world, at least this is back when it was published 20 years ago, a New York court concluded that a gestational mother who received an egg from an anonymous donor was the legal mother of the child born in the surrogacy arrangement. And the court based its decision on the surrogate's intent to procreate and raise the child. In other words, this is not an arrangement where you pay a woman a very hefty sum in order to carry the baby to term, and therefore, if she, the surrogate, has full intention to be and function and serve as the mother of this child, she is the child from both sides. This logic of the New York court has no bearing on halacha whatsoever. This is what you call ethical reasoning. Now, I'm not coming to laugh at ethical reasoning, don't get me wrong, but it's not halachic reasoning. And that's why the Torah is the Torah, because it has its own way of thinking, its own rules and regulations. You know, you want to know what was the nature of the relationship between, you know, the future child and the surrogate mother. And that's a moral issue which the courts have to address. But the halacha has to address a pure legal, Jewish legal issue. Who is the mother of the child?
There's Dina, but then Dina. We follow the law of the land. But
not in this case.
But in the case of inheritance of a father, I think
there's a different
issue involved there.
But now, the question that I want to ask with you, is there any sugya somewhere in the Talmud which would give us the opposite impression? Remember I told you that there are five different sources that we have to deal with. We're up to number three. We started with Arla. We went to the case in Yevamos of a mother who converts during pregnancy. And now we get to a third sugya. And this sugya is in Masechta Bechoros. On pages 13 and 14, which I hope you have. Yes, no, maybe so? Mm-hmm. Okay, you have 13 and 14? We have here an essay written by a person that I consider a friend of mine, Rabbi Ezra Bick, who's a Rosh Yeshiva in Har Etzion Yeshiva. Now, before he invokes the sugya that we want to call our attention to in Masechta Bechoros, which you'll see in a minute on page 14, he rejects the proof of Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. And how does he do so? And basically, if I were to present what I think is the counter-argument that Rav Ezra Bick presents here, we'll have to see again the text in English in just a minute, it works like this. You know when the surrogate mother is considered the mother? When the hora has no halachic significance whatsoever. Meaning, if we want to determine motherhood, and we want to know if these two twins are sons of a mother, and therefore they're brothers, maternal brothers, then in this case there's only one choice. Why? Because the hora was shelo b'kedusha. Do you follow me, Rabosai? At what was the mother's status at the moment of conception?
No.
She was not Jewish. If she's not Jewish, then if you want to determine the Jewishness of the child, meaning who's the mother, then in that case, what we call the genetic, but that is totally irrelevant, because the halacha, when it determines yuchsin, is not interested in conception of a non-Jewish woman of, in this case, twins. That's irrelevant. It's a non-starter. It's completely neutral, meaning it doesn't exist. It's a zero on the radar screen. In that case, what are we left with if we want to determine motherhood? If we've already excluded stage number one because that's how Rosh Hashanah Tush, what are we left with? Rabosai, are you with me? There are only two possible moments of time that can determine motherhood. It's either the moment of conception or the moment of birth. If you've told me now that the moment of conception halachically is a non-starter, it's a null set, it doesn't register, then what are you left with by process of elimination?
Birth.
That's called Leda. But the problem is, they were born to a non-Jewish woman. And what's the answer to that problem? She's Jewish. Why is she Jewish? Because she underwent gerus before the leda.
Right.
So then, in that case, the surrogate mother is considered the mother. But if the genetic mother was Jewish, in that case, it could be very well argued that the genetic mother is the mother of the child, because then that that hora was a hora b'kedusha, as opposed to the case in the Masechet Yevamos. Let's just read it inside. He says, line 4 on page 13, he says, the case of the mother who converts does not prove that birth is sufficient to determine legal, meaning halachic, maternity in the absence of a... Just one second, I didn't read this right. The case of the mother who converts does not prove that birth is to determine legal in the absence... I think there's a word missing here. Only in the absence of a genetic relationship. So in the conversion case, he's saying something else. I see what he's saying. He's saying that maternal identity... Okay, so let's just skip this. I'll leave this for you. Let's take a look at the Gemara in Bechoros. Does anybody have a Gemara in Bechoros here? Actually, it's not in Bechoros. I made a mistake. It's in Chulin. It's in Chulin. So if anybody has a Gemara Chulin, that would be helpful. It's on Daf Ayin in Chulin. Maybe on one of these benches, one of these chairs or tables, there's Gemara Chulin. No. That's not Chulin, is it? Okay. All right. The Gemara Chulin has a very strange case in which, again, I don't know the, you know, I don't know the reality here. You'll have to tell me if this is possible. But what you do is you take two animals and you attach them in such a way that the fetus can be transferred from one animal to the other. This is, again, mind-boggling. The Gemara, in a certain sense, anticipated 2,000 years ago a technology that's, what is it, 25 years old, whatever it is. It's very modern. And now the Gemara wants to know, that's why I thought it was a Mechasech the Bechoros, but it's a Sugim Chulin. The Gemara wants to know whether or not the animal that will be born eventually from this fetus is the firstborn of let's call us Sally the cow, or of Molly the cow, right? Molly's the one who actually gave birth to the cow. Right, and we have a principle called Petarechem. Now the Gemara assumes that it's very likely that the second animal is certainly now exempted from Pidgin Aben, meaning that there's Petarechem, because Petarechem depends upon the birth. But the Gemara has a suffix. Is it possible that the first animal whose uterus was attached to the second animal, and at that point it already was pregnant, so there was already a fetus in the first animal, that she now loses her status as far as the next child, meaning she's already no longer a Peter Rechem? But Rabbik is very careful about reading the language of the Gemara. The Gemara says, if two wombs were attached together, and a fetus emerged from one womb and entered into the other, what is the law? Do we say, this is all part of the Gemara, do we say its own womb, that's called Didei, is exempted? In other words, it's treated as if she gave birth already to her firstborn, while the one not its own is not exempted, or perhaps the one not its own is also exempted. In other words, it could be possible that even if you assume the first woman, right, I shouldn't say woman, a female animal, who had a fetus, is exempted, you know, it's as if she already gave birth, it's possible that nevertheless the second animal that actually gave birth is also exempt. But you see that the Gemara assumes the day, meaning that the use of the term the day indicates that the Talmud views the first animal as the mother. It might, even though the first animal is the mother, it might not be so that the Petarechem applies to the mother, because it's not enough to call her the mother, she has to actually give birth to it, but that's halach and peter rechem. But as far as who is the mother of this future fetus, it certainly is the day. The Gemara never questions that premise, that the animal belongs to the first, right, the born animal, the fetus belongs to the first animal. On this basis, Rabbi Bick concludes that conception determines halachic maternity, rendering the genetic mother, as opposed to the host mother, the mother for halachic purposes. And he mentions that there was some other poskim that accepted this logic and this position, that's the genetic mother who is the mother. Let's go on to two other sources. First, let's talk about the Gemara of Basar B'chol. This is on page one of your Hebrew pages. I cannot find an English version of this Gemara. Okay. The Torah says, Lo sevashel gedi. What comes next? B'chalav imo. Now, which word is going to be the critical word for us in our discussion? Imo. Why? Because the Iser of Basar B'chol doesn't apply to all milk. Mm-hmm. It only applies to milk of a mother. Mm-hmm. What does this mean? So the Gemara says that if you slaughter a cow and you find milk inside the cow, you're allowed to cook that milk with meat on a Doraisa level. The Rabbanim made Gzeris on it. But according to Torah law, there's no problem in taking that milk and cooking it together with meat. Why? Because that's not called chalav ha'em. Only a woman who's re'uya loledes, who has the potential of giving birth, is considered an aim. But you took this milk out after shechita. You removed it from the animal's body after it was dead. Once the animal is dead, it's not considered re'uya lele, and therefore the milk is not considered milk. Interesting, Shakespeare would have a blast with this. Is milk milk? And the answer is milk is not milk in this case. Now, we go on to the following case. We milk the cow, so the cow is alive, but it's not well. That's called what? A trefa. A trefa means an animal that's going to die within a certain period of time. It has a puncture, an injury to one of its internal organs. Have you ever heard of Rabbi Akiva Eger? How many people heard of Rabbi Akiva Eger? He lived about 2 centuries ago, a little bit more, maybe two and a quarter centuries ago. He was probably the greatest mind in Ashkenazi Jewry since the Ramah, 5 centuries. Anyway, he says the following. What's the status of the milk of a trefa? Says Rabbi Akiva Eger, it depends upon the following factor. Could a trefa, a cow that's a trefa, a female cow that's a trefa, conceive? And he has raias, Rabbi Akiva Eger, from various sugyas, that although a trefa is not capable of giving birth, it's not healthy enough to give birth, it will conceive. Says Rabbi Akiva Eger, the chalav of a trefa is considered chalav. What does that prove?
That if it conceives, it's a
conception. That's sufficient for this cow to be considered chalav ha'em, for the milk of the cow to be considered chalav ha'em. She has the status of an aim simply because she's ru'uya l'horas, l'hiroya. So if you take a look at the page in front of you, you will see that, again, I'm just going to point to the line that's the punchline for us. I don't know how to tell you how to find it.
Yeah.
You see that line?
Uh-huh.
It's the last line in the paragraph that starts, Ha'ibur kegorem liyichus l'chora yesh lochiach mizeh. From this Rabbi Akiva Eger, we can prove She'em, what's the Torah, the halachic legal definition of a mother? Nikreis mishas ha'ibur. That since she became pregnant, she's already considered the aim. Will she ever give birth to this animal?
No.
To this calf? She can never give birth to the calf because she's a trefa. Im kein, therefore, b'sheila shalanu, havlad mityaches achara em she'ivra oso. The genetic mother is the mother of the child. So what do we have now? We have, I think, two against two. Am I right?
Yeah.
Let's go over this. From Arla, we prove that the surrogate host mother, the birth mother, is the mother. From the Gemara Yevamos, again, according to at least Rav Zalman and Nechemya Goldberg, we prove that it is the birth mother that's the mother. So we have two proofs that from the Talmud that is the birth mother that's the mother. Against that, we have the sugya in Chulin, which seems to indicate that it is the mother of genetics of conception. She's the mother of the child. We have now another sugya to support that, and that's the sugya of Cholav HaTreifa, since the Treifa is Ruilus Aber, therefore the Cholav is considered Cholav HaEim. She is the mother. Now what happens if you have two against two? So you need a fifth source in this case to be Machria the Suffolk, to cast the ultimate vote. And that sugya is here in Masechta Megillah on the bottom of your page 1. And that sugya is developed on page 2 by the Beis HaOtzer. The Beis HaOtzer, his name was Rav Yosef Engel. I don't know if you heard of him. He lived about a century ago. You could probably have made two Einsteins from his brain. It's mind-boggling. I never cease to be in awe of his thinking. I thought I was half bright, but I'm totally dumb. Reading his chidushim, his insights there, they make me feel like, totally like a real loser. You get chalish sadas. It's like if you could, I don't know, everybody in their own profession, if you compare yourself to the giants in your profession, you know what I mean? You get sort of depressed, because. Okay. So Rav Yosef Engel says the following. The Gemara Megillah wants to know, why does the Pasuk say first that Mordechai adopted Esther because she had no parents, and then the Pasuk repeats itself and says Ki ein la av o'em. So our focus today will be on those words, ki ein la av va'em. So the Gemara says the following. Ein la av, meaning when her mother was pregnant, her father died. So at the moment that she was born, she had no father, ein la av. And the ein la em means that her mother died at childbirth, and at the moment of birth, she had no mother because the mother died at childbirth. Again, I'm not exactly sure. There's something called Gita Miyoda Bar Kachas. Maybe her mother died simultaneously with her birth. But the Gemara assumes that when she, Esther, emerged as a viable being in this world, she had no mother. And that's what the Torah says, the Tanakh in Megillah Esther says, Ki ein la av va'em. Let's go over it. She has no father because her father died before she was born. And not only that, she was born without a mother because her mother died at childbirth. Very tragic, correct? So that's why Mordechai adopted her. Says Rav Yosef Engel, what do you mean she has no mother? How can the Gemara say that she has no mother? She has a mother. Why? What mother does she have?
Gestated her the whole 9 months.
Right, gestational. And not only that, she certainly has a genetic mother. Yeah. I mean, there's no question about that.
Right.
But she doesn't have what? A birth mother. Because her mother died at childbirth. So her mother never got to see her after she gave birth. As I state in the Gemara, again, you can't argue against Rav Yosef Engel. Says Rav Yosef Engel, when you see from this Gemara, if the Gemara says that she doesn't have a mother, and that's the pasuk ki ein la em, because her mother died at childbirth, you see that maternity depends upon birth.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
On birth. So now we have three against two. We have five sources. We had a tiebreaker, and now we have a tiebreaker. The tiebreaker is that the surrogate mother who gives birth to the child is the mother. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Unless we can find the sixth source. So now here's something fascinating. The sixth source is in Rashi. And Rashi quotes a Medrash. The Medrash tells us, which I think you have on page 5. Oh, excellent question. Okay, now this is the first question that I want to bow down to you, because I adore you for asking that question. We'll come right back to that question. But let's just see Rashi's Medrash. Chazal say the following. Leah gave birth to 6 Shvatim, and she became pregnant again. Now Leah understood that if that child, if that fetus that she conceived would be a male, she would end up having 7 Shvatim. And what that would mean is that in the breakdown between Zilpah, Bilhah, and Rachel, Rachel would end up being cut out from the Shvatim. So Leah turns to the Ribbono Shel Olam, according to the Medrash, and she works out a deal with God. And she says the following. In event that I give birth to a male, let this male go into the fetus, I'm sorry, into the uterus of Rachel, so that she can give birth to the male. If, on the other hand, it's a female, then I'm happy to be the mother of a female.
Right.
Now what happens? Rashi, in the name of the Medrash, says a miracle happens. And this fetus goes into the body of Rachel, and Rachel gives birth to Yosef. Rachel, on the other hand, was pregnant with a female. That female fetus jumps into the uterus of Leah. There's a swap here. Who is that uterus?
Dina.
I'm sorry, who is that fetus?
Dina.
Dina goes into the fetus of
uterus.
Into the uterus of Leah. So now we have the following situation. Yosef now becomes the son of Rachel. Rachel gave birth to Yosef. This would indicate that who does the halacha recognize as the mother?
Birth.
The birth mother.
Right.
Just one second. The birth mother. Now, if that be the case, then Dina now is transferred over to Leah. Dina becomes the daughter of Leah. Why? Because who gives birth to Dina?
Leah.
So Rachel gives birth to Yosef, hence Yosef is one of the Shiftei Ka, who is the son of Rachel. Leah now gives birth to Dina, and now Dina becomes the daughter of Leah. Why? Because Leah gives birth to Dina. So again, let's just go over this. Rachel gives birth to Yosef, and she's the mother of Yosef. Who was the genetic mother of Yosef?
Leah.
But Rachel is the birth mother. Who is the genetic mother of Leah? Rachel. But who is the mother of Dina? I'm sorry, did I get that wrong? I meant to say Dina. Right? Who is the genetic mother of Dina? Rachel. Who is the birth mother of Dina? Leah. The Torah says that birth mother is the mother.
That's a medrash, though.
Okay, so I'll get back to your point in just a minute. I have only one last thing to say before I get back to your point, and with your point we'll have to conclude for today. What time is it? Oh, it's almost 10:30 and the bell rings at 10:30. Okay. So we have 2 more minutes till the bell rings. I'm very, you know, I have to observe the boss, right? He's the boss. Oh. On page 6, you have a presentation of the Ratz Kitzvi. Okay, his name is Rav Tzvi Reisman, and he lives in L.A. And he's quite a Talmud Chacham. He's also one of the biggest Bali Tzedakah in the Haredi world. He's an amazing individual. So if you want to meet him to get money for an institution, it's only during certain specific times, because the rest of the day he's either making money or he's learning on his own and writing his books. And he says the following. That there's another medrash that says that Shimon married Dina. Mm-hmm. Now this is why.
That's right.
Dina, as you know, was raped by Shechem. Mm-hmm. And she had a pagam. She was, so to speak, you know, used material. She was,
right,
like, she was second, I don't know, a blemish. Oh, I'll use the word blemish. She was blemished.
Right.
So Shimon gets up and says, you know, he was the one who, he was the pro-Dina guy, right? He was the one who destroyed the city of Shechem because of what happened to protect the honor of Dina, but now nobody wants to marry her because never she was raped. So he says, I'm going to marry her.
Who's his mother?
Oh, now watch this. His mother is unquestionably Leah. Oh, that means that he is the son of Leah both from the the conception perspective, genetically, and from the birth. There's no question that Shimon is the son of Leah. No, unless my Depolik, that was not an issue. Now, if we're saying that Leah is the daughter, I'm sorry, if we're saying that Dina is the daughter of Leah because Leah is the birth mother, then Shimon could not possibly marry his own sister, his maternal sister. Right. Now you may say, well, it's before the Torah was given, but Chazal say that the Avos from a Kain called Tarkul even before it was given at Sinai. How could Shimon marry Dina? So the Medrash answers that Shimon can marry Dina because Dina is the daughter of Rachel. And they're not, and it, again, before Matan Torah, all Erevah relations depend upon the mother. That changes after Har Sinai, but again, we don't have time for that. That's the Sugya and Sanhedrin. So that Dina and Shimon have two different mothers. Now wait a second. We know that Leah gave birth to Dina. So how can you tell me that Leah gives birth to both Shimon and Dina and they don't have the same mother? Mm-hmm. The answer is because who conceived Dina? It was none other than Rachel, correct?
How would Shimon know that?
I don't know. Again, how did this whole miracle happen? What do you say?
These are all medrashes.
Oh. So again, I just want to point out to you that we suggested that it's 3-2, right? In all Talmudic, if we take, again, there may be other sources that we don't know about. I'm not telling you that I know Shas, but I'm saying if we take an excursion through the Talmud, we came to the conclusion that three sources indicate that it is the surrogate host mother, the birth mother, that is the mother according to Halacha. We came with two other sources that came to the clear conclusion that it is the conception mother, who is the genetic mother, if you want to call it that, who is the mother of the child. So that's 3-2. It doesn't look too good for the position of Bick and all those who agree with him that it depends upon the genetic mother. She is the mother. However, according to this presentation of the Ratz Kitzvi, we have one medrash at least that maintains. So again, in the medrash that we saw until now, that Shimon is the child of Leah, right? No, I'm sorry, I messed up there.
Yeah.
That Yosef is the child of Rachel, and Dina is the child of Leah, right? That major would clearly indicate that we have another support for the position that depends on the birth mother. But now we have a medrash that seems to indicate that maternity depends upon the genetic mother. Hence, Shimon can marry Dina because genetically, in her genetic code, she has the genetic code of Rachel, not of Leah. So now we get to your question. Can we decide, is it valid to introduce midrashic sources? So there's something here called the Encyclopedia Talmudit on the bottom left of your page 5. And the encyclopedia quotes a very famous principle which you invoked before, that's called Ein Sonchin al Agados. Mm-hmm. We do not derive any conclusions from Agados.
Right.
However,
You can't assume.
In the next paragraph, he says the following. If, let's say, the Talmud will lead us to nothing more than confusion, in other words, at the end of the day, we've exhausted the Talmud, and we really don't know what the final position of the Talmud is, then we look towards the Haggadah, and the Haggadah will give us the final solution. Now, what you don't have in front of you is page 6. Page 6, whatever number it is, I don't know. Anyway, there's a long tshuva from Rav Avadya Yosef, who knew everything, and Rav Avadya comes to the conclusion that if there are contradictions in the Talmud, and we really can't clarify it, then we look towards the Haggadah. And the Haggadic statements, according to Rav Avadya Yosef, will determine the final halacha. And he gives a number of examples to illustrate this. So getting back to your question, if at the end of the day we conclude that there are all sorts of ambiguities here on this issue, we don't have clarity as to what the final conclusion is on who is the mother of this child in the case of surrogacy. Is it the genetic mother or the birth mother? Then, according to Rav Avadya Yosef, if you're left with exhausting the Talmud and coming up with no conclusion, then you introduce what? Agadita. And any statement in the Medrash or in the Haggadah becomes halachically binding. Okay, Rav Osei, at this point, I officially end the shiur, and now we're ready for questions, but I have to do one thing before we start our questions. I have to open up this door. Okay.
I have a question, or another position that can be established here.
We'll start in what, 5 minutes? 6 minutes.
So, we say that you have to look at the birth mother as one of the three out of six. I'll give you a seventh.
Woo. Okay. Are you a Daf Yomi? You know, old Shas.
Conception takes place. Genetic mother. Something happens to the mother, and they take the fetus and they put it into an incubator. Now, incubator equals birth mother, as far as I'm concerned. She is incubating. But I'm talking about not a human
incubator,
but a mechanical incubator, and that fetus grows inside completely, and it reaches birth and is born. That would refute the concept of the surrogate mother taking the
motherhood status.
How's the zygote fed in an incubator?
What's that?
How's the zygote fed in the incubator? Where's the umbilical?
Again, according to many sources of the Talmud, in his case, there is no mother. Because we might have shocked there's no mother. The genetic mother is not a mother.
No, there's no birth mother.
Well, so this person is born without a mother.
Well, no, the answers are simple. The genetic mother is the mother.
I don't know. Maybe no. We're saying that in order to be a mother, you have to be a birth mother. If you're not the birth mother, then...
Right. Well, that argues against it.
You have no proof. If you quote a Gemara, then that's one thing.
I can quote something.
That's what I'm saying.
It's disputable. We don't know who Dina's mother is except with Rashi.
Maybe out of the...
Joseph is indisputable the son of Rachel. You don't have to go through a medrash for that.